Good afternoon. This is Edward Mazur, Chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our program today, a most challenging program and informative, featured Arne Duncan, former head of the Chicago school system, former Secretary of Education under Barack Obama, and the head of the Emerson Collective and CRED in Chicago. His core message, the current approach to ending violence and gun violence is not working. We have to take prevention to scale and look at it from some other perspectives. In addition to Arne Duncan, our panelists included Jervon Hicks, a life coach, Billy Moore, who's overseeing CRED alumni, Aaron Taylor, one of the alumni, and the Reverend Marshall Hatch, Jr., who runs MAAFA, an organization in West Garfield Park. Mr. Duncan asked his friends to join with him and share their stories because, he said, their story is our story. It's about young men who are left to raise themselves, feed and house themselves, protect themselves from a cruel world that never really gave them the chance that many of us had. Like everyone else, they need to eat, pay rent, take care of their families, and the only path that was open to them was in the illegal economy. There were no summer internships in high school. No one handed these folks an apprenticeship in a union so they could learn a trade. No one made a phone call, got them that first job that put a little money in their pockets and a line on their resumes. The only people in their community who took them under their wings, unfortunately, were gang leaders in the streets. These leaders taught them how to make some money, gave them guns for protection, showed them how to use it. Eventually, the law caught up with all of these folks, and they ended up in prison if they were lucky. When they got out, some of them went right back to the streets. It's all they knew. But some of them have become affiliated with organizations like Ready Chicago, Communities Partnering for Peace, and Chicago CRED, and have started to turn around their lives. Arne Duncan and the panels will try to show you how they are the solution for the future. They have some most interesting and challenging thoughts on how society has come to this point in time and what it will take to dramatically reduce gun violence.
Thank you so much. And by the fact that you all are here means you're missing the Chicago Sky Parade, so I apologize for that, but I appreciate you being here. And I think it is an honor to be back here. I've been able to do this for many years at this point, but I thought this topic is so important. Rather than just having some talk or lecture that we really hear from the experts on violence. And I think this club often hosts the powerful. I don't know how often you hear from the true experts. And what we have here is a panel of young men who are living in this world every single day. This is their life. And how we get to a better place as a city, I think there's no one better to hear for you all to hear from them. And I'm going to leave plenty of time for questions at the end, and please ask anything. We're always very real and raw and honest, and apologize if that offends anybody, but I think it's the only way to get to the facts here. Just a quick intro on, just give you my Saturday morning, woke up to a call from the police who were asking if I could help out with a young football player at Morgan Park High School who had just gotten shot, luckily survived, see if we could do something for his family. After that call, got a call from the principal, Michelle Clark High School, Charles Anderson, his star basketball player, Kiara Moore, had just gotten killed Thursday night, and it was her and her twin sister's birthday on Sunday, and trying to work through that issue. So South Side, West Side, we have representatives from the South and the West Sides here, which is why I wanted that. And then decided to walk outside and just go for a little walk, clear my head, and it's all kinds of chaos on the corner, and an elderly gentleman and his wife had just been carjacked. They were bringing in the groceries, and three young guys had come and gotten to an altercation there just on our corner. And so this is the reality that folks across the city are living with, and we have to get to a better place. We have to get to a better place. So we'll get into a conversation. We won't do long intros, but I'll just sort of introduce people as we get into questions. But I'll start with Marshall at the end. And Marshall and his father. Where's Pastor Hatch? He's here. Please give Pastor Hatch a huge round of applause. He's someone I've worked with for a couple decades, and Marshall's doing an extraordinary job. And Marshall runs, one of our close partners, runs the Myoffa Redemption Project in West Garfield Park out of the church. And Marshall, take a minute and just sort of walk through the historical context of the My Alpha Redemption Project. What does that mean? Yeah. And just describe your program.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for being here. Thank you for clapping for my dad. That's my hero. Essentially, the My Alpha Redemption Project is an extension of New Mount Pilgrim Church, located in West Garfield Park. I'm sure we all know West Garfield has been struggling for a long time. Church has been in the neighborhood since 93, and my father's been in the trenches, and so many others connected to that church. They've been in the trenches for decades. It's the old St. Mel Holy Ghost Parish that we bought from the Archdiocese in 93. And the beautiful stained glass windows, you know, representing your European representations of Jesus, they were kind of falling in. So the church had a decision to make. Do we invest in restoring this art, or do we sell this art and try to put in our own? We chose the latter. One of those pieces is the Ma'afa Remembrance window, which is the largest iconic display of the Middle Passage or the transatlantic slave trade in the world. And so from that inspiration, that was installed in 2000. From that inspiration, we created the Ma'afa Redemption Project because we believe that the young men in our neighborhood are best to redeem that history. So we invest in them with housing, mental health support, life coaching. We call it spiritual life coaching because it is a faith-based movement, and a host of other supports. And we've been at it for about 5 years, the highs and the lows, the violence right next door. But we remain hopeful that what we're doing will work.
And just follow up, Marshall, what has changed in your program? What have you learned? What are you doing differently now than you were 4 or 5 years ago? And talk about residential model.
Yeah, so it's a housing first model, which of course means, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You kind of have to meet the basic needs before self-actualization happens. And so for us, that was housing. And the church over the years has invested in abandoned properties, and the young men work to restore those properties, and they live on the campus of the church, almost dormitory style. And the learnings, I mean, I've learned so much about myself. I've learned from the young men so much. I'm reminded of Octavia Butler's quote, you know, everything you touch, you change. Everything you change, changes you. And I think what we've found out is we need a more holistic vision to do this, not just about direct service, but community development. You can't have one without the other. So right now we're working with 15 community liaisons who are alumni of Ma'afa to restore the neighborhood. And we're basing the vision of the new West Garfield Park around what they want to see for them and their families.
Thanks. I'll go to Billy on my left. And unfortunately, Billy, your life has been touched by gun violence in a whole number of different ways. Unfortunately, tragically, you took a life. You've had your son killed not too long ago, shot 16 times. A couple weekends ago, your stepson was shot. Thank God he survived. And you've had a gun put to your head and been in some tough situations. Billy came to us from Iman, one of our great partners on the Southwest side. Now he oversees all our work with our alumni from across the city. And as you work with our young men and starting women as well now, what are the biggest lessons that you try and instill in our young men?
I think one of the biggest lessons that I want these young men to walk away with is their greatest strength is their ability to think. The ability to reason. A lot of times these young men resolve conflict based off their emotional, feelings. They respond to whatever the situation is, and then they instantly get angry and they want to kill somebody. You know, that's not going to put them in the best situation after they made a decision based off how they felt. So what I try to do is to get these young men the understanding that the greatest attribute that they have is their ability to think. You have to start outthinking your problems. You have to put your thoughts ahead of your feelings. And unfortunately, so many of these young men that we see, you know, who have died or who have killed someone, their first response was based off how they felt. So what we do, we try to get these young men to start thinking through their problems. Because to me, the mind is the greatest attribute that any human being has. The weakest attribute is your feelings. So if we can help these young men start outthinking their feelings, then I think we can be successful in reducing gun violence.
And I'll go to Mr. Hicks, who's technically a life coach for us, but he's on the streets more than anybody. So he's half life coach, half outreach worker. He's everywhere. And for a long time, you were caught in the streets, carried a gun in and out of jail for a while. And you talked about sort of the powerful addiction of having a gun, and talk about what that was like growing up in that environment, how you were able to break away from that. And now as a life coach for a lot of young men, including Aaron, and he'll come to you next, what are you trying to instill in them? What lessons?
First of all, thanks for having me. Just again, I say all the time, people don't understand the power of a handgun. Growing up, it was probably the best thing at that point in time that ever happened to me. I instilled fear in just about anybody that I had a problem with. But I got to a point where I became disgusted. Came home, I think, 2015. I was offered the opportunity to either waste the rest of my life or make use of it. And I became a life coach through training. And it's just like right now, when I look out here and see, you know, I overcame some of them obstacles and took advantage of my opportunity. And that's what has me here today. Couldn't think of a better place to be. Then again, when I look back and I see all the time I spent being locked up, all the gray hairs I put in my mother's head, I didn't want to beat her to her grave. So, you know, I figured out it's either now or never. And plus, the streets is undefeated. They ain't going to lose. So we try and steal that into the young men and women we deal with. It's definitely not a fair game. It's a real life situation, and we still, again, losing lives. So.
And Aaron Taylor's one of our alumni, came through the Youth Peace Center, which is one of our great partners on the South Side in Roseland, sort of where our programming started with Mr. and Mrs. Jones, who are extraordinary. And Aaron's now, well, we'll get into what you're doing, but it was interesting as we talked. I grew up in Hyde Park. My father was a professor at the University of Chicago. We basically lived on campus, and I grew up affiliated with the University of Chicago, still live there. That was my affiliation from birth. Based upon where Aaron was born, based upon his neighborhood, based upon where his block, he had a different affiliation from birth. Doesn't make me better or worse, doesn't make him better or worse, but in a city of probably only grew up 4 or 5 miles from each other. It's not that far geographically, but worlds apart. But just for folks who didn't grow up in a community like that, what's that like growing up in on the far south side?
First off, everyone give a round of applause for Mr. and Mrs. Jones for the YPC. So where I'm from, you know, there's only one opportunity when I was growing up, and that was to join a gang. I was raised by gang members, excluding my mom. She's right there. I was raised by gang members. You know, I looked up to gang members. You know, my brother, he was a gang member. You know, so that's really what my life revolved around during that time. You know, as I see you guys here, you know, dressed in your suits and, you know, and blouses and everything, just dressed professionally. You know, we weren't taught that as kids. You know, we always thought you guys were like the uppity type. You guys were too goody-goody or things like that. But, you know, as I've gotten older and I've connected myself with programs such as the Salvation Army, Chicago Urban League, YPC Center, and now affiliated with the Iman, you know, organization that Billy has helped me with, I just, you know, I seen a different side to you guys' lives. I know just because you guys have on the suit, you know, some were born with the funds to bless, but at the same time, I know people who just like you guys who were born into money, but they also worked for it. So I don't really judge you guys at all, because I know you guys probably had a hard growing up too. Look, you know, regardless if you guys were born into the riches, I know you guys worked for hard for your lives too. So, I mean, that's pretty much.
And lots of folks, and again, we have a variety of folks here, so I don't want to be too broad-based or stereotype, but lots of folks think people who carry guns are like fundamentally bad people. They're definitely scary people. They're definitely threatening. Talk about at what age you started carrying a gun and why.
I was 14 years old. And it wasn't, I started carrying it because, you know, like I said, I wanted to be like the gang members. Not necessarily knowing what was going on during the time. I just wanted to follow the wave. And of course, you know, as I've gotten older, I got in some trouble with guns. A lot of people, during that time, people carry guns, you know, just to have a name for themselves. I never wanted a name for myself, but I did want to be a part of what was going on during that time. You know, now carrying a gun is just for fun, you know, and I've gotten in some trouble. 2017, the first gun case of 2017, got caught with a gun. 30 minutes after, my mom told me she don't want to get a phone call saying I'm dead or in jail. And she ended up getting that call saying I was in jail. So, guns, people now, they just carry it, you know, just for the fun of it. Guys are shooting just for the fun of it. Guys don't know the history of their neighborhoods or where they from. Some guys carry guns because they easily get mistaken. Some guys carry guns because they put themselves in situations where they have to carry guns. During the time I was in high school, I put myself in situations where I had to carry a gun. But as I got older, I really didn't, you know, I stayed away from the drama, you know, and I moved on into bettering myself. So as far as for me to say, I'm forever what I am, but I don't, you know, go by it anymore. So I'm a gang member, but I'm not a gang banger.
Mm-hmm. And I always say all of our young men and women across the city, they all have role models. It's just a question of who those role models are. Everybody's being raised by somebody. Mm-hmm. And Aaron talked very honestly, like many of our guys, of who they are raised by. And they're raised by folks on the street because folks in rooms like this, we are absent. And folks in the street are present, and that's who their role models are, and our absence makes that possible. But as you've gotten older, being around Mr. and Mrs. Jones, having Hicks as your life coach, working with Billy now, what lessons have you learned from just a different kind of role model? They're also role models, you know, before, but what have these kind of folks instilled in your thinking or made you think about your own life?
Mr. Jones, they showed me opportunity, many, many opportunities. Mr. Hicks, he showed me that you could be from the streets, but you can also have a mind of your own. You don't have to follow the leaders. You know, I know you guys probably see, or sometimes on social media, see guys saying free Larry Hoover or free Jeff Ford or King Gino or whoever. But people fail to realize that if they decide to free those guys, and that's a big if, they're not going to come home on that gangbanging stuff. They're not going to come home and try to calm anything down because they don't know anything about this generation. You know, guys my age, we react off emotion, you know, and I say we because I've reacted off emotion numerous times. You know, I've been suspended 14 times in my high school, throughout my high school career in 4 years, and I've reacted off a lot of emotion after my cousin got killed. So that's mainly what, you know, kind of got me into the physical part of the gang life. But yeah, Mr. Hicks, you know, we, in conversations about life, you know, he kept my head focused. And Billy here, knowing who he is by watching 30 for 30, knowing, finding out about him, you know what I'm saying, through that, kind of, you know, messed up because in the situation that he was in and the consequences that he had to pay for. But as he reached out to me after I became a CRED alumni, you know, he's connected me with the E-Man organization. They've offered many, many opportunities. I'm in the Weekend Warriors program. I've recently acquired my MIG and TIG welding certifications. So, there's all kind of opportunities here. I met Arnie before I met Arnie. You know, playing basketball, that's another story. But other than that, though, man, these lot of role models here, man. You guys are actually role models, you know, because a lot of us, we see on TV and we see you guys, you know, with suits and living life. And not saying living life in, you know, nice houses, nice families. You don't have to look over your shoulders. We do, you know. We get mistaken. Lord knows how many times. I've cheated death 5-6 times, but I keep going. And, you know, but that was when I had myself in those predicaments. And now that I've evolved, you know, and listening to these guys, and of course my mother who's sitting right there, you know, it just kind of, I kind of realized that I was, you know, effing up. So, yeah.
Marshall, you've talked a lot about your father, the massive health disparities. The, you know, the average lifespan in Garfield Park is whatever, 15, 16 years shorter than the lifespan of someone who you know, happens to live downtown. One of the things that contributes to that shorter lifespan is obviously the level of violence and the death. But one of the things that I think as a city we haven't focused on nearly enough is how few shootings and homicides get solved. There are very, very few, if any, consequences. And the recent data has come out that says out of 100 shootings, whether fatal or not, in Chicago, only 18 result in an arrest. So 82% chance that there are no consequences. And that is the lived experience of basically all of our men. But what's interesting is you dig into that data, there are even disparities, not surprisingly, between communities. So in Garfield Park, where you're from, when there's a shooting, there's an arrest 11% of the time. Mm-hmm. So basically 90% of the time, no impact. But if you live in the Loop or Norwood Park, there's an arrest 40, 44% of the time, so four times more. And you can't really talk about violence here in Chicago or probably anywhere else and not talk about race. And when you hear that 11% of the time there's a consequence in your community, in other communities it's four times that, what does that tell you about how young men in your community are valued by our city?
Thank you for that, alley-oop. The reality is we can't talk about interpersonal violence without talking about structural violence first. Structural violence in education. So there's one charter school in West Garfield Park, and last year that charter school led CPS in suspensions. And the kids weren't even in school. Economic violence, of course. Well, I'm sure many in the room are familiar with the Madison Corridor, right? Pre-68 Dr. King assassination riots, how vibrant that was, and it really hasn't been restored yet. That's intentional policy. Fast forward, I mean, when we talk about Invest Southwest, West Garfield Park didn't make the cut. So these are policy decisions, and we're seeing the day-to-day effects. And we have to talk about the structural violence first. Why? Because, of course, they have racial implications. As you duly noted, you know, 77 neighborhoods, communities in Chicago. West Garfield Park ranks number one in potential life loss, which is a metric for premature death. So it is the gun violence, but it's also the other things. Hypertension. So it's like death by a thousand cuts for many of those who live there. And on top of all of that, rumors of displacement and gentrification. So if you can imagine those elders who've lived in the neighborhood for decades, and now that there's a whiff of change coming, they're scared that they won't be there. So we have a decision to make, of course, in Chicago. I was looking at the 2020 census data. Of course, demographics nationally are changing. They're also changing in Chicago. 80% of the children in Chicago are children of color. So this is not just about charity. This is about strategy. We have to invest in young black and brown kids for the future of the city. And if we don't do it now, the window of opportunity is fastly closing.
So much of the... So much of the violence we face is actually retaliation, because there's not justice in the criminal justice system. People think they have to take the law into their own hands. If no one else values my family, my cousin, my guy in my block, then we have to show our value for them. And so we're always trying to stop the next shooting and stop the retaliation. And the most powerful way to stop retaliation is through reconciliation. And 34 years to the day after Billy unfortunately took Ben Wilson's life, had an incredibly powerful reconciliation with Benji's brothers, probably the most powerful night of my life. And then he has said, and I believe him totally, and I learned so much from him, that if the young man who killed his son came into our program, that he would not retaliate, that he would take him into the program and mentor him, that he can't ask for forgiveness and reconciliation if he can't give that. But what's it like? What was it like to spend that evening with Billy's brothers? And what's it like? How do you have it in your heart to do something? If something happened to my son or daughter, I don't know if I would be able to do that. Right. And how are you able to come to the place where you actually think you could bring that person in who took your son's life and try and help them get to a better place?
Well, at 16 years old, I had one of the greatest gun problems that anybody could ever have when I pulled the trigger and ended Benji Wilson's life. And I felt that the weight of the world and the energy of the hate, particularly from the city of Chicago, directed at me. 41 days later, when I was in Division 6, after I turned 17, I was taken to the boiler room and by three Cook County sheriffs, I was told that I was going to write a letter to my mother saying that I couldn't cope. So basically, they were preparing to end my life in the basement of Division 6 in the boiler room. And basically, you know, I prayed that I would walk out of that boiler room, which I did. I understood the energy and the hate that was directed at me based off a mistake that I had made because I decided to pick up a gun. And I tell these young guys, when you pick up a gun, you get gun problems that you may not be prepared to deal with. A lot comes with that. So because of everything that I felt, the hostility and the hatred for me because of the mistake that I had made, you know, and I don't underestimate the mistake because it cost somebody their life. I didn't look at Benji's celebrity. I looked at him as a human being that I have to live with. I felt as if, you know, 20 years probably wasn't enough of a sacrifice. There's something else I may have to give up. And I didn't know that that would come in the form of me losing my own son who was shot 16 times. So I couldn't be a hypocrite when I stand in front of the young men that I work with every day to try to get them to understand how to reconcile a situation before it leads to the loss of life and them possibly spending the rest of their life in jail if I couldn't find within me the same type of forgiveness that I just wanted people to show towards me when I was 16 years old and made a mistake. So I was able to come out of that boiler room, you know, and I'm here today. So in order for me to really do the work that I do, I can't be willing to now go back and be like everybody else who harbored that hate and that energy towards me for the person that killed my own son. You know, sometimes in life, when you decide to do things or change the way you do things, the test that comes your way to prove that you really have changed will be the greatest test that you may have to face. And that's what, you know, that's what anything that's worth changing for. So when my son got killed, I had to make a decision. I got a call. Because I was all the way up north registering for school when he got shot. And maybe 10 minutes away, I got another call. And my cousin, she said, they putting the tape up around the car. So I asked her one question. Is he still in the car? And she said, yeah. So at that moment, I knew he was dead. So right then and there, I knew that was my sacrifice. And I had to have forgiveness in my heart at that moment for whoever was responsible for doing what they did. So the night that I had the opportunity to sit across the table from Ben Wilson's two brothers, although I did 20 years and it was 30-some years later, if this is what they needed to kind of heal from their grief, I was willing to do that. Because my job right now is a healer. You know, when you see these young men killing people out here in Chicago, we already... Jalen can give you the numbers, how many homicides we've had this year. You know, that's a behavior of pain that we see being acted out from trauma of young men who basically we pretty much thrown away. We said they're not worthy. I have to help heal these young men before they get into that point because I've healed. I'm a healer. You know, you see young men pain, what we say. You know, people who are in pain, you know, hurt people.
Hurt people.
You know, I cannot continue to hold hurt and my heart and work with these young men if the only thing I'm thinking about is killing the young man who killed my son? Like, everybody thought about what they needed to do to me. So I have to be opposite. I'm out here healing people. I'm out here trying to help people to understand the right way of dealing with their conflict. So I felt it was a responsibility for me to help his brothers heal. I did my time, I was done with that, but they were willing to sit across the table. So if this is what it took for me to help them heal from their resentment and their pain, then that's why I showed up that night and I sat across the table so that they can understand also the man I was and the work that I was doing, you know, with Chicago Cred to help these young men who are out here that's creating grief the way I did.
And unfortunately, like, 82 to 90% of shootings, the case for your son has not been solved. You and I know very, very likely who did it. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have to retaliate. There are folks who would do that for you. That's been offered. Why do you turn down that request?
Because like I said, I cannot stand in front of the young men that I work with every day to ask them to change if, in fact, that I'm still basically the same. Like I said, that was the test for me to know that I have changed. What I wanted, I can't expect people to get in me if I'm not willing to offer it, which was forgiveness. No one knows the pain of a death that's close to you when somebody is murdered unless you experience that. And I hope that no one who hasn't experienced that will have to experience that. But that's a pain that will never go away. That's a void and a hole in your life that could never be filled. But at some point, you have to understand, like Marshall talked about, the conditions that create this hopelessness in young men that we're working with. You know, we have worked with over 300 young men since Chicago Cred has started. And we've identified maybe 1,100 to 1,200 young men that we need to work with. For the first 3 years, we've experienced reductions. But, of course, we all know what happened the last couple of years. So that lets you know just how much more work that needs to be done, how many more young men that need to be touched in order for us to get to where we need to get at. And that also means that everybody in this room, if you feel kind of disattached from what's going on, I just heard about a police getting shot yesterday at Lake Park.
Close to here.
Yeah. So it's starting to come a little closer to home now. You know, this city is a great big city, but it's a small city as well. You know, violence can be proximate, but it can also extend beyond its borders, in which we tried to contain it by neglecting certain areas and thinking that that's not our problem. Oh, it's everybody in this room problem. Yeah. Everybody. Because it affects the bottom line.
Just one comment, just to build upon what Billy said. You guys probably know this. I hope you do, that Chicago is 6 times more violent than New York, 3 to 4 times more violent than L.A. So we are absolutely the anomaly. We don't have to be this way. Other cities have figured this out. People often think, oh, more violence, we need more police. New York has the same number of police per citizen than us and 6 times less violent. And L.A. has significantly less police than us and is significantly less violent. And again, this is not anti-police by any stretch. We work with police all the time, including this weekend, as I mentioned. But when the city's up 50% in violence, and with randomized control trials coming out of Northwestern, who's been evaluating our work, we're showing a 50% reduction in victimization, 48% reduction in arrests. City up 50%, we're down 50%. There's never one easy answer. But the fact is, a city we're choosing not to scale the kind of work that these men are doing across the city is a little stunning to me. Mr. Hicks, part of what we do is we go, mostly pre-pandemic, we got to get back doing it again, is go to Cook County Jail and recruit guys out of there. I've had some amazing young men come in because we're always trying to work with the guys most at risk of shooting and being shot. And unfortunately, Cook County Jail has some of them. And for you to go in there as a free man and spend some time and talk and walk out as a free man, that was a little bit of a different experience. What was that like for you?
So it's really indescribable. If you ever been incarcerated, you know, you had to go through strip searches and all this. So this one particular time, he said, we're going to go talk to some inmates. I said, okay, cool. Right, so it was, we get out of the car, I'm already taking my belt out, my shoestrings. And he's like, no, Hicks, you don't have to do all that. And so we go through the back, greet a few people, they let us in. So as I'm putting my belt back in, I'm still holding it out. I know that's the procedure, they want to search it. But it was a great experience because I ended up going on, it's a little different when you actually incarcerated and you know it's a certain amount of time you can use the phone or use the restroom or you got to eat by a certain time. When you get in there as a free man from someone that been in that position and you get to talk to young men and you see these doors being clicked open and you say, wow, I've been here. And of course, in my mind, I'm never going back unless it's a situation like that. And I also got to engage some individuals that was actually from Roseland, which made me feel real good inside. And lo and behold, as they was released, two of them became participants. And was actually doing real well with the program. But it's no better experience than to go back and be able to teach someone from your mistakes so they don't make them over again. So that's how I looked at the situation. And I do look forward to doing that again sometime soon because I think they fed us too, kind of. There wasn't no jailhouse food, but so I was appreciative of that. But just a great opportunity, man, to be able to sit here. I often look, again, I always say this, it's not about me or about the Billies. It's about the team effort.
Yeah.
You see me as a life coach, but you don't understand. I have a staff that I work with that we kind of attack individuals together. It's not just Hicks one-on-one. And I learned through that the best experience is learning when you need help as a coach. It may not be my battle. I may need a Mr. Jones or a supervisor. So it works out well for me. And I just appreciate the opportunity and appreciate you guys having me here. I'm a little nervous, but I'm okay now.
I told Hicks I'm nervous every time I do this, so it's good to be a little nervous. Three final questions, and I want to open up to you guys because it's really important to hear from you and to get a chance to talk to these guys. This is obviously a pretty civilized environment, but I've been with you, unfortunately, on a block with a homicide. Mm-hmm. With trauma and chaos and just sort of the worst imaginable situation, one of our young men. And explain to folks here what those situations are like and what you try and do in those situations to calm things down and to stop the next shooting.
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, again, shout out to our outreach team. We got 6 to 8 outreach workers, both men and women, who are on the ground just about every day. That was my first pass in outreach. So a few months ago, we had a young man, very young, very charismatic, great energy, team leader. Unfortunately, within a few weeks of us engaging, he was killed, freak accident, or, you know, however they may say it was. But it just was the chaos I'll never forget. When we went to the block, it was maybe like 200 people out, detectives running around, helicopters in the air. And so at this point, you know, I don't know if any of you ever been at a live homicide. It's all type emotions in there. Even the pets is jumping around the gates because there's so much going on. And I just remember telling this one young man, go home. Go home. Go home, right? So I don't know what happened. Next thing you know, I see his feet in the air. And they throwing him in a paddy wagon. And lo and behold, right after that, he did his mother the same way. And then they did her sister the same way. And these relatives to our participant. And I just remember Arnie asked me, what should we do? And this is what I love about me. I'm real spontaneous. And so I thought to myself, what would work right now? Because fighting the police ain't going to get it. I don't know if people think that's the new lottery, getting a lawsuit. I don't want to be a part of that. Because you might not survive to see the money. However, I asked Arnie to grab his side. We had now this is not just me and him. It's like 10 workers out here, outreach and everything. So everybody gets somebody that's excited, right? And you got to think of people calling you out your name and F the police and this, that, and the other. We literally picking people up, holding them against the gate. Like my body, you between me and the gate, and just whispering in the ear, don't lose. Don't lose right now. And that's what we tell them. Don't lose, because it's not a winning situation. And lo and behold, you know, as time went by, everything settled down. But it was just this one officer. He just wouldn't let it go. And I say that to say this. You know, you never know who want to talk in the community about what happened. But there's always one spoiler, whether it's an officer or a neighbor, that'll kill the vibe, right? It's nowhere in the world nobody wants to talk and say what's happening. Right. You're just afraid of who to talk to. I'm not condoning who you talk to, but at this point, it's time for somebody to step up. Until it hit home, then that's when everybody want to talk. So with that being said, you know, start helping people monitor your kids when you can't monitor. And that's what we ask people. It starts in the house. We only build a relationship with them. And when they get home, it's a different relationship. So we try and ask for people inside at home, you know, to help kind of tune things in with us so we can provide the right services.
We have amazing, amazing days and graduations and all kinds of celebrations and great stuff. But I also don't want to blow through the hardest stuff. And unfortunately, we have lost. And as we work with more and more men, the honest reality is we'll continue to lose some. And unfortunately, recently we lost alumni, actually from the first cohort of Iman, Albert Mullins. I mean, not Iman, of Maiafa. And he was an alumni working with Billy, was at our CredMade manufacturing facility. We're creating jobs for men. And I'll just say, Marshall, I haven't even told you this. That morning when I was at the church, I saw your life coaches. They were helping your young man put their ties on. And it was this unbelievably father-loving gesture. But it hit me that obviously our men's fathers aren't there. So your life coaches are doing it. But then the thing that really hit me the hardest was normally you're putting on a tie, it's like for a wedding or for a graduation or something. And your young men were putting on ties to be pallbearers, to go to the service. And then in too many of our communities, that's the rite of passage. That's the transition. It's not the graduation. And it broke me a little bit to see that. I had to walk out. And just want to ask you how you handle these situations and how does the community keep moving forward when we lose a great young man like Al?
Yeah, I personally didn't handle that well because we were so close. He was a part of the first cohort. We had 12 young men in it. He was actually the residential assistant in the housing. So he made the other guys do their chores. He was just a leader. And really born into it, you know, his father was deep in the streets and his father was killed a year before he came to us. And I remember L telling me, he went by L, his nickname, that everybody in the neighborhood knew who did it. His mother was actually, you know, saying, what are you going to do to protect the family? So he was faced. This is not who I want to be, but you know, is this what I have to do? Is this who I have to be in order to get justice? You know, and it kind of puts flesh on those statistics that you cited earlier about the homicide clearance rate. But yeah, I didn't handle it well. I mean, I leaned on my father, best pastor in the world, not just saying that. He actually is writing a book called Cornerstones. It talks about his experience really ministering to families, preaching eulogies, just being a healing presence, as Billy mentioned. But that takes its toll as well. And so it's the community of faith that is the miracle that is New Mount Pilgrim Church. We support each other. You know, we were doing wellness checks before the pandemic, you know, so it's we lift each other up. We encourage each other. But that was hard for us. I think moving forward, our goal is to do more to develop leaders like Elber. Like, that's what we've been inspired, because that's who he was. That's his legacy. So I'm actually headed right after this to a leadership retreat with 15 of our guys in Green Lake, Wisconsin, because we believe that that's one of the keys as well, developing young men who will, better than you and I can, speak to the younger ones, 11, 12 years old on the streets.
My last question for Aaron, then we'll open up to you guys, is I've read about, you know, business leaders, you know, worry about the violence. They're going to leave the city. Their company's going to leave the city. I say all the time that our young men are the solution to the problem. They're not the problem. They're going to lead us to someplace better. But as Aaron and I have talked, and he's going through this welding training, he's going to have some skills, be able to make some real money. He's talked about he needs to leave the city. And for me, that loss is as great, as significant as any business leader in here, because we need him in the community with young guys talking his leadership. So just to Aaron, a question for you, not to put you on the spot, but what would it take for you to stay in the city, to raise your family here? How would the city have to change so that that would be a viable possibility and you wouldn't have to feel you have to escape a war zone to achieve some peace? And believe me, I understand that. I absolutely understand that. But what would it take to keep you in the city?
First, I need a lifetime contract with the Chicago Bulls. can't really say too much. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. So even if I leave, I'm gonna still be here. You know, my mom will be here. You know, I plan on moving away, yes, but that's just only because I need a change of scenery. I done been to Chicago my whole life. I done been downtown, up north, northwest, east, south, however you want to say it. I pretty much done everything down here, all the events. I need a change of scenery. You know, I'm going to go somewhere where I could look less over my shoulder than what I'm doing now. You know, like Billy could be sitting here, yeah, but I still looking over here because, it's just the paranoia that guys my age, we deal with because of the situation we put ourselves in coming up. But to answer the question, I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. Like I said, I just want to take my trade. You know, I have 7 long months left before I graduate trade school. And after that, like I said, I just want to take my trades and I want to go ahead and apply it to something else, to another city. But I'm far away. I'm forever Chicago. I'm not going nowhere.
Aaron, we need you to stay.
Out to the coast. I got
you. Well, I think this was an incredible program, wasn't it? A lot of thought. By the way, if you'd like to listen to our comments, we are the City Club partners with WGN Radio, 720 on your AM dial, and we do a podcast of this program, so you can go back and revisit. We have several questions here, and by the way, Arnie, are you going to talk to some of the press people afterwards?
I have to.
Okay, because there are a couple of questions here that deal with, as you can imagine, politics, and we'll save those for the news conference afterwards. Thank you. This question here, well, several of you mentioned that these killings, these shootings, that people in the neighborhood know who are responsible for them. And we often read in the paper statements made by police authorities that there is a lack of cooperation in the community. What are the most important things that can be done to improve this cooperation between community, people like yourself, and the CPD?
I'll start quickly and open it up, and I would be really, really clear here. It's not a lack of cooperation, it's a lack of trust. And you have to... The only way life works is you build relationships. There's nothing about the name Maiafa or YPC or Cred or Iman. There's nothing in name that changes lives. It's all relationships. That's the only thing that matters. And when you have police who have relationships with folks in the community and there's trust, good things happen. Our first peace treaty we put in place with Alderman Beal and his ward and build a playground. We had two groups, a lot of bloodshed on both sides. They got tired. They put in place a peace agreement. They went to the local police officer who lives in the community, happens to be a woman, which is not surprising, and basically talked about it with her. That's community policing. When police are an invading force, when we're at a homicide scene and Mr. Hicks is trying to calm things down, they're trying to arrest him, when they don't know who's who, you don't have a chance to do it. I'll stop. Yeah, I got strong opinions there, but anyone else?
I want to say something.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's definitely about relationships, but relationships is hard to build if you got a police officer working in Englewood from Mount Greenwood. You know, Mount Greenwood has a generational, it stretches all the way back probably to when they was doing patty rolling and chasing slaves to right now policing that's coming to work in communities that they're not from. And they don't see themselves as serving and protecting. It's all about enforcing the law. So you will never be able to build relationships with that type of mentality when you come to work every day, when you see the community that you work in, not a part of the community that you allegedly supposed to be serving and protecting in.
Thank you, Billy. This is an interesting question. It's from Sarah Spunt with an organization called Lift Chicago. San Francisco recently started paying people $300 a month if they did not have a gun-involved incident. Have you thought about incorporating restricted cash payments as part of violence prevention interventions? Any thought about that?
Well, to be clear, the young men that work in our programs, we do pay them. We pay them to participate. We pay them to get life coaching. We pay them to get, we didn't talk enough today about the clinical services helping our men heal from trauma. That may be the most important thing we do, pay them to get their high school diplomas. The complication, and this is a really, really hard one, we have real tough and honest conversations. The vast majority of guys carrying guns in the city are carrying them what we call defensively, playing defense, because they do not feel safe. And so you can see all the stats about how many guns the police get off the streets, and we're fine for getting the guns off the streets, but that has zero correlation, zero, with reducing violence, because the vast majority of people carrying guns are carrying them only because they don't feel safe. And we work with guys over time to put those guns down, but we have lots of young men who, because they live in war zones, because they don't feel protected, and I'm not justifying it, but I do understand it a way I didn't 5 years ago, who feel they have no choice other than to carry a gun, and they recognize the consequences, and they choose those consequences rather than the possibility of them dying. So this is a really complicated, Aaron, I don't know if you want to speak. I mean, so Aaron's had a gun case, carried guns, so.
Yeah.
If I'm wrong, say I'm wrong. So.
No, you're not wrong at all. Honestly, how you mentioned how San Francisco, they pay. So you have guys throughout organizations that, you know, if you pay them, you know, for that time, you know, you're paying them for that time, and you just want them to get the experience to see if this is something that they would pursue later on down in life. You have guys that will do that, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to put the guns down. Like I say, as far as situations, okay, guys are in situations. So you basically, they will agree to put the guns down to come to this program. But once they leave, they got to pick their gun up again because they still got to make a home. I know guys that carry their guns in grocery stores. In Chicago, it gets like that. You know, guys will shoot grocery stores, parks, rallies. So, for them to come to the program, you paying them, but they're not going to bring a gun to your program. But when they're back out on the streets, the guns, they're going to come back.
And quickly, sorry, so much we didn't talk about, but just very quickly, one of the things our street outreach team does that's so important is they try and put in place non-aggression agreements and peace treaties with groups that are in conflict. And when you do that, we put in place over 40 across the city, and sometimes they're tenuous, sometimes they fall apart, but they've been really, really important. And when you do that, you get both sides to commit to not shooting, then you create the space where people can put the guns down. But you have to have that kind of work, and we continue to try and expand upon that across the city.
And I have one more comment. And what Arnie was talking about, that is possible. My best friend in high school, he's from the opposite side. We've been best friends for 11 years now. My mom considered him as a son. He's been to my house. I've been to his neighborhood. There's been no problems on either side. So it's possible, but only if guys want it.
Okay, we have several questions here along the same line of discussion. This is from Dwayne Deskins, who's a former federal prosecutor. He wants to know about an effective gun strategy. Does Chicago have an effective gun strategy to reduce violence? If not, why not? If they do have it, could you tell me what it is?
Yeah.
Who wants to deal with that, Mr. Blue Jay?
I just want.
Why he's wearing that Blue Jay hat.
I just. You got me. It's a tough question because in order for you to understand about gun violence and who carrying guns, you got to get your shoes dirty. So I don't know if the people asking these questions ever been to the neighborhoods where the gun violence is at, but it's no specific answer to that. You can walk past somebody who with a fresh haircut and pants pulled up, and he had the biggest gun in the world, and you can walk past somebody with his pants sagging, you see his underwear, he has nothing. So it's all in putting your feet on the ground and communicating with the environment that you live in, and then you'll absolutely for sure know who to engage. But that's just my ask. No definitive answer to do we have a...
Just really quick.
I like to make...
I'm not sure if America has an effective gun violence problem.
Probably true.
Yeah, and I think it's cultural. I mean, Richard Slotkin, he has a trilogy of books. One of them, Gunfighter Nation, talks about the American ethos, right? The Wild Wild West. We celebrate John Wayne killing the natives. I mean, this is in our DNA to an extent. Now, when it comes to moving forward, of course, we need a revolution of values. I mean, but we've killed our prophets. King talked about militarism, racism, and materialism, the triple evils of our society. That's a prescription. We need to revolutionize what we value. We need to value. 70 children have been shot in Chicago this year. Like we have to think differently. We got to reimagine. And we have to start trusting each other. I did want to say one thing on the police thing. I do think it's important to acknowledge the FOP's outsized influence on the way things are on the ground. I mean, if you have a president, a guy like John Catanzaro, who one day celebrates what happened January 6th and then tries to recant. He's the leader of our police department and encouraging police officers not to get vaccinated. And we all are. I mean,
he won't be honored by you or Creda as the man of the year. That's for sure. We do have another couple questions. I'd like to try to squeeze them in. Thoughts about bail reform? Who would like to jump on that?
Really quick, I don't appreciate the back and forth. I don't think it's helpful. I think we can have both bail reform and public safety. And the way that the conversations have been had is that it's either or. I think we can do both. Of course, yeah, I think...
Very good. I have a couple of questions here. I'll just mention a few names. Jack Lavin with the Chicago Chamber of Commerce, Jack Hartman, someone, Lawrence, he's with CRED, I think he's a member of your organization, and Katrina Waddy. Katrina, we invite you to become a member of the City Club, and Harvard Singh over here, a member of our City Club. And the questions are, what can people in this room do to help organizations like yours and help reduce the kind of violence we're seeing in the city of Chicago currently?
Well, first, I think when you see things happening or how it's been reported out, not to prejudge, not to see just the numbers, but understand that, like Marshall said, put flesh on those statistics. These are people that are going through real situations out here. So with that being said, also, you have a vote. We have to change policies, you know, as it relates to how we regulate guns in the city of Chicago. We have to start demanding more out of our policymakers to be more equitable as it relates to education and things that affect the structural violence that leads to what we are trying to reduce gun violence. Mm. I think, like I said earlier, violence is proximate, but it's starting to extend beyond those borders. Mm. So you are definitely no different from me as becoming perhaps a victim of some type of random violence that we don't ever want to see happen. So just get involved, get more educated, and make your vote count towards something that's going to uplift this city.
Aaron, and then I know Javon has
reassurance. You always want to, you guys, you say the question is that what can they do to help, you know, organizations? Just, you know, assure, help them assure that organizations that change can happen. You know, where I'm from, if any guy was to see a suit or a blouse, we thinking RICO cases. We not even thinking nothing else. So, you know, so like, just, you know, reassure the organizations, show the people in the city that you can put a t-shirt, some jogger pants, some gym shoes on, and you can get down and dirty with us, and we can make our, you know, fix our community gardens, community car washes, things like that. Put people in other positions. Not saying you guys don't care about the community, you know, not saying you do. I mean, who knows? We all have our own thoughts, right? But it's just, you know, what we going through. And like Billy said, people are here going through some real, real hard times. So, you know, you just want to assure them that they, you know, they can be safe.
Mr. Hicks.
My response is for all the business people in the room who have businesses, provide some of these young men with opportunities that's not in our neighborhood where they're prone to violence. And learn to trust the process.
Well, there are a number of business people here, so that's a real challenge. Thank you. I have one last comment, and it's directed at Arnie Duncan. Thank you for bringing the group here. Thank you for coming to City Club. Former head of the BGA wrote in Cranes about a week or two ago that you should become the anti-violence czar in Chicago. Would you be interested if such a position were to appear?
I second that motion.
I don't have a great answer to that one. I'll just try and answer your other question, maybe, is that I just want people here to understand that these guys are the solution. They're not the problem. We have to invest in them. We talk about jobs all the time. All of our guys need jobs at the back end. I can't ask them to put down the guns and not have a legal way to make money. We have people working in all kinds of different industries. We have two of our alumni working at law firms downtown, working at Deloitte. And it is a different talent pool than some of you guys are used to. But these are men, just like Aaron, who are leaders, who are committed, who are resilient, who want something better for themselves, for the families and community. And if you want to write us a check, that's fine. But honestly, we'd prefer you to hire at the back end. And we're not going to give you somebody right out of Cook County Jail. They'll work with us for a year, 18 months, whatever, and get them to a place where they're able to do that. But you have to invest in these men. You have to invest in these communities. You can't have these kind of disparities that Marshall talks so eloquently about that have been true. You know, King came to North Lawndale in what year? 60, was it 66?
66.
66. In North Lawndale, we're trying to triple down and quadruple down in North Lawndale right now because it's still so tough. And so we will either decide we have one city or we'll keep deciding we have 70 or 80 neighborhoods. And that's the fork in the road. And I think you guys can lead us to a better place.
Okay. Thank you. Aaron?
Yes.
If you can do two things for us. Someone's card out of there.
I got a card.
Okay. And then make your comment.
Mr. Hicks said, the business women and men. How Arnie said, we're not gonna send you guys straight out of the county jail. But even if they have at least 2 or 3 weeks some sort of experience, and if you guys have a position that, you know, they may be interested in, you know, just don't deny them. You know, I encourage some of these businesses to have programs where they can help them achieve so that they can, you know, instantly, once they, you know, got their reach those achievements, they can come right in and, you know, start their apprenticeship with you guys, or, you know, just give them opportunity. They don't necessarily, like, you know, say a guy has been out for a month and he has 2 months certification, carpentry, and he doesn't have the full knowledge of it. And you guys are looking for a full experienced guy. I mean, I wouldn't say turn him around. He has some knowledge. So you guys have programs within your industry to, you know, get him up to basis. Then he can instantly start work, you know, things like that.
Thank you, Aaron. Okay.